Kathy Curtis is the author of two previous biographies of women artists, Restless Ambition, Grace Hartigan, Painter, and A Generous Vision, The Creative Life of Elaine de Kooning. Her next book will be a biography of the novelist and essayist Elizabeth Hardwick. Curtis was elected to a two-year term as president of the Biographers International Organization in 2018. We're excited to have her here at the GWC to talk about Alive Still, Nell Blaine, American Painter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I actually stepped down from that position because of the press of doing what I'm doing. The biography of Elaine de Kooning is going to be made into a feature film, so that's involving me in a tiny way. But so about Nell. Before I actually read, I just want to explain where we are in her life. So she's born in 1922 in Richmond, Virginia. And because I refer to this in this reading, she had an eye condition called strabismus, which plagued her. She had, as a child, she had several operations that didn't work. Finally, when she was a teenager, she had a successful one. So I'm mentioning this because, well, you'll see. And another thing that you'll discover is that she knew a great many poets. She was quite close to some of them, and some of them are, you know, well known, and some are not. When she was 20, she left home for New York and sort of never looked back, except for coming here. And she vacationed here, beginning really in the 50s, and then finally bought a home here. And so she became a fixture for nearly 6 months of the year. And perhaps some of you knew her. Anyway, so I'm reading from a chapter that is a really pivotal time in her life. Her entire life changed at this moment. And then after this, I'd be happy to, I'm hoping we can kind of talk about writing and writing biographies. Tomorrow, I'm going to give a slide talk, really, about her life. Okay, Ben. So she managed to get, you know, artists don't have money, but she managed through her freelance work to get enough money together to go to Mykonos in Greece. Well, why did she go to Mykonos? Because an artist of Greek origin had told her that it was a, you know, terrific place to paint, and also that there were government-run studios that you could get very cheaply. Well, she didn't like the government-run studios, but she found another place to stay, and it was blissful. The sunlight was too bright for her to paint outdoors. But so what she would do is she was staying in the home of some people she met, and she would paint the view from the window, and the view from the window became a real leitmotif in her painting life. But she did make sketches, but it was just too intense for her to paint. So anyway, she was very, very happy. She was painting, she was meeting people. And in fact, in early September, Jane Freilacher, the painter, greeted Nell's rapturous letter from Greece with mock envy. "There must be a few unpleasant things you can come up with," she joked. Oddly enough, there were. For some reason, Nell was feeling terribly tired, too exhausted to paint. Hoping to snap out of it, she rented a boat to a small island. When the boat docked, she jumped off and collapsed on the shore. Shrugging off this show of weakness, I thought, oh, I'm really just getting old, she returned to her studio. By now, this malady, whatever it was, had affected her mental state. The subject of her most recent painting, the last one she would make on Mykonos, was unlike any she had attempted before. Based on a magazine photograph, why had she cut it out? Her watercolor showed an athlete carrying one of his exhausted fellows after a race. Feeling stiff and cold and plagued by a severe backache, Nell was now hardly able to walk. This is Marshall Clements, one of the American friends she met there. Clements called a local doctor who diagnosed the flu. A second doctor agreed. but Nell showed no signs of recovery. Frantic to get another opinion, Clemens found a German tourist who was a doctor. His examination determined that she had polio, a disease with potentially crippling outcomes that were virtually unknown in Greece, where primitive sanitation gave most people immunity to the virus in infancy. The polio virus enters the body through the mouth. How she caught the disease, perhaps by drinking polluted well water or from swimming in the sea, and whether her immune system might have been compromised after her bout of pneumonia the previous summer, she would never know. However, there was a reason she was particularly vulnerable to the virus. The inactivated polio vaccine, IPV, required a sequence of three doses. The second one a month or two after the first, the third at least 6 months after the second. Nell did not bother to get the final one. As a result, she had only partial immunity. 3 years earlier, 27-year-old Tanikil Leclerc, a beautiful and gifted dancer with the New York City Ballet, made a seemingly snap decision to forgo the polio shots administered to the company before a European tour. In Copenhagen, where friends noticed that she looked unusually thin and tired, she became severely ill after a performance. The next day, she was paralyzed. Although she eventually regained upper body strength, Leclerc spent the rest of her life in a wheelchair. Her brilliant career, more than 30 roles have been created for her uniquely charismatic style, was tragically cut short. In an eerie coincidence, a decade earlier, she had danced the role of a polio victim in Resurgence, a ballet choreographed for a March of Dimes fundraiser by company director George Balanchine, whom she married in 1952. He danced the role of the specter of polio. The charity, March of Dimes, named for its solicitation of dimes from children, was founded by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had contracted polio at age 39, to find a cure for the disease and provide care for those already stricken by it. On September 22nd, with the clock ticking on Nell's life, Robert Dunn, this is another friend, got in touch with the American Embassy in Athens. Nell's friend Michael Bank, who was the vice consul, picked up the call. He was working as a visa officer, assisting Americans with emergencies was not one of his duties. "But I was in the office when the call came in," he recalled, "an American citizen gravely ill in Mykonos who needed to be evacuated immediately. They feared she would not be able to last the 8 to 10 hour boat trip to Athens." That's the location of Evangelismos Hospital. He contacted the Greek Air Force, but they were very wary and refused to send one of their helicopters. What to do? "I put on my thinking cap. We were friendly with Captain Skull, the naval attaché, so I called over there and explained that Nell was not only an American citizen, but a personal friend. Was there any way he could send a seaplane to evacuate her?" He readily agreed. Lying on a stretcher at the dock, Nell, who had still not been told of the seriousness of her illness, watched the plane repeatedly try and fail to land because the waves were too choppy. The sequence of events diverges here. Bank believes that the seaplane eventually rescued her. Another version has Dunn and Clemens huddled in a phone booth hiring a helicopter. An unlikely scenario, Bank said, considering the dearth of civil aviation in Greece at that time. According to this version of the story, when the helicopter arrived, the pilot refused to let her board because no Greek doctor had signed off on an evacuation document. Frantic with grief, Flora Creasy, another friend of Nell's, burst into tears and demanded that he take her. The pilot relented, and Dunn got into the helicopter with her. Whichever aircraft she wound up flying in, she arrived in Athens in a perilous state. Her blood, depleted of oxygen, gave her skin the deathly blue cast of cyanosis. She was hallucinating, close to death. Evangelismos Hospital had a staff doctor who was familiar with polio, and even more crucially, the only iron lung in Athens. This device, the iron lung, which kept a polio patient alive by simulating normal breathing, a motor lowered the air pressure, forcing the patient's chest to expand, letting air flow into the lungs, and then raised the pressure to produce an exhalation. The machine breathed according to a rate set by a doctor. A few days later, after a tracheotomy that cleared her lungs and allowed a breathing tube to be inserted, Nell was moved to the U.S. military hospital, where a newer iron lung model had been dispatched from Tripoli. She remained in it for 17 days, while Dunn and Clemens took turns by her bedside, reading to her and writing letters to her art world friends. Decades later, when Dunn was dying, Nell called, it's just so intense, you know, called to tell him that he had given her the gift of life. She would never forget his gesture of putting a flower on the iron lung. Meanwhile, someone at the hospital sent her mother a shockingly brief, bleak telegram. Condition worse. Her recovery is questionable. Prognosis poor. Nell was almost completely paralyzed below her neck, with the exception of her left hand, which she could move slightly, and the fingers of her right hand. She was unable to swallow and in constant danger of choking. In 2 weeks, her weight had dropped from about 137 pounds to a skeletal 90 pounds, and she had lost control of her bodily functions. There was like a hole where my stomach was, she recalled later. The pain was so great, I felt like I was burning alive. Pain medication could not be administered for fear of interfering with her labored breathing. She hallucinated a hatchet chopping her leg and a bird pecking at her. I was convinced that two nurses had abducted me for some macabre medical reason, she said. Another nightmarish vision featured a black box with a painting she had done in Greece, repeatedly sinking into the sea. Yet, in a merciful form of compensation, Nell also experienced a strange euphoria, which she attributed to the intercessions of friends. People she had met in Greece visited her at the hospital. They apparently opted to forego wearing the mask the hospital required to shield them from Nell's still contagious disease, so that they could talk and read to her. When she was at her worst, a doctor from Boston, whose name she never learned, stayed up all night to oversee her care. During these weeks, flowers, a get-well gift that had a special resonance for this passionate lover of blossoms, and tons of mail, arrived from her friends at home. Jane Freilacher mailed a money order to Athens for some little extras you may need, masking her shock and concern with hopes that the old Blaine guts, stamina, and perseverance would save the day. Denise Levertov claimed to know someone who had polio and made a wonderful recovery one would never know. Frank O'Hara sent an upbeat telegram from the CFM Rooting Society in care of Dunn. Edith Burkhardt, another friend, wrote a heartfelt note telling Nell, New York isn't the same without you. Composer Stefan Volpe mailed her a lucky stone. When the news reached Tom Hess, he was the head of Art News magazine in those days. He was vacationing on a yacht in the Aegean Sea. He let Nell know that he had gotten in touch with a very nice group of distinguished Greeks whom he hoped would facilitate her return to the United States. Seven people, technicians, nurses, and a doctor, accompanied Nell on a U.S. military air transport plane, a flying hospital with a small iron lung bolted to the floor. In Wiesbaden, Germany, she spent 3 days in a full-sized iron lung. Barbara Fusener, Michael Banks' sister, who had known Nell in New York, was living in England at the time, and she traveled to the hospital to visit Nell. I remember being so struck with her wish to go on painting, Fusener recalled. The only things she asked me to buy were art postcards. There were mirrors in the iron lung that allowed her to see them. As soon as she was sufficiently stabilized to travel across the ocean, Nell was flown to McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. Able to breathe on her own only for 40 seconds, Nell had to be calmed down before the transfer from the hospital's iron lung to the one on the plane. On October 14, the plane touched down after an 18-hour flight. A group of Nell's friends was waiting in the rain to greet her as she was hoisted down to the tarmac, encased in the iron lung. She was immediately admitted to Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, where she would spend 8 months in the Jack Martin Polio Respirator Center, nearly as long as her time in Greece, as the oldest person in the ward. You know, in those days, only children in America got polio. At first, doctors were not certain whether she would live. She had bulbar spinal polio, the most severe form of the disease, which affects muscles controlled by the spinal nerves, as well as the cranial nerves responsible for breathing, swallowing, and speech. Gradually, Nell regained her breathing ability, beginning with 5 minutes a day. Eventually, half her diaphragm was restored. For the rest of her life, the loss of the other half would sometimes leave her breathless. If I hadn't had a strong heart and a strong stomach, I would have died, she said later, because everything else was nearly gone. The day after Neil was admitted to Mount Sinai, her mother told a Richmond newspaper that she was waiting for the doctors to tell her when it was wise to visit. Dora Blaine told the local press that Neil's recovery was likely to be rather long and drawn out, but she has an indomitable spirit, and that's going to help. Worried friends of Neil's kept sending letters inquiring if there was anything they could do. Referring to her departure from Greece, William Keenbush joked that Queen Frederica never got that kind of send-off. With her note, Elaine de Kooning enclosed a talisman, a tiny painting of a bull. Pauline Hansen assured Neil that the good Catholics here are praying you into a fine recovery, and I pray my pagan prayers. Neil's devoted collector, Arthur Cohen, would either buy a painting or just send her money every month during her hospital stay. As soon as she was allowed guests, her friends rushed to the hospital. Meadie, and this is Meadie Garth, her modern dancer lover at the time, took the bus uptown every day to check on her. Jane arrived with comfortable cotton outfits and assured her that she was looking stronger. Edwin Denby brought her fancy canned goods. Rudy Burkhart fixed up a rotating cylinder with the text of Jack Kerouac's On the Road so that Nell could read it in the iron lung. Dan Flavin, later famous for his light sculptures but a painter at the time, came to the hospital to visit his twin brother David, who had a severe case of polio.
It's never happened before.
Oh, why not? she could talk only during the moments when air was expelled from her lungs by the machine, which made for somewhat stilted communication. Although some hospital staff did not look kindly on the constant stream of visitors crowding the L-shaped ward, Dr. Avron Y. Sweet was determined not to deprive us, Nils said later. The respirator center director was tough but just, and a very caring and skilled doctor. His innovations included insisting that the patients be fully dressed. He told family and friends to bring brightly colored clothing. Dr. Sweet had the ward painted in beautiful primary colors, a gesture that was particularly cheering to Nell. He even allowed patients to smoke, going so far as to have an engineer rig up a device that would hold the cigarette. At appropriate intervals, he forced us out of bed, whether we felt like it or not, she recalled fondly. Neil also praised the other doctors on the ward because they consider the whole patient, not just the disease. Dillis Evans, a 22-year-old English nurse, began working at Mount Sinai in late January 1959. As a teenager, she had wanted to become an artist. Her father's response was, "Girls get married, boys go to college." So she devised a roundabout plan to get to art school, inspired by a newspaper ad offering nurses free passage to America. Confident that her high marks in biology would stand her in good stead, she completed her training at Dudley Road Hospital in Birmingham in August 1957. The following July, Dillis successfully applied to a program that provided guaranteed employment at Mount Sinai. Meanwhile, after rejecting a doctor's proposal of marriage, Dillis had become engaged to a lawyer. As she recalled years later, "My friend said, 'He's a big deal and he's handsome.' But the spark was missing. Feeling bored out of my mind, she broke with him before she came to New York. After her shift at the hospital was over, she took night courses at the Art Students League, which led to her transfer to the polio unit to care for Nell. When Dillis first stepped into the polio ward, she was taken aback by the deafening whoosh, whoosh of 10 iron lungs running simultaneously. "You won't hear anything in another minute," the head nurse assured her, explaining that her brain would quickly adapt to the decibel level. Spotting Nell's head sticking out of an iron lung, she moved closer to her patient. "Oh boy, are we going to get along," Nell said. "You're gorgeous." Dillis recalled that Nell was smiling the whole time, looking forward to my taking care of her. Still believing that she would be entirely cured, she was in a good humor, cracking jokes despite her incarceration in a metal tube. When I could see that she was beginning to move her legs, Dillis said, I opened one of the portholes, breaking the vacuum seal. Nell was talking about Mae Swenson, de Kooning, the village. She's babbling. Then she said, "I'm getting a little tired." I said, "You've been breathing on your own for 15 minutes." And she screamed for joy. "We're going to get along, girlfriend," she said. On October 30th, Denise Levertov visited Nell and learned that she could be removed from the iron lung for increasingly long periods. She was able to move her left hand and arm and the fingers of her right hand. Levertov was obviously willing herself to understand that, little though it seems, quote from a letter she wrote, this news was significant. "She is extraordinarily courageous, full of humor and spirit," the poet wrote to a friend. What a future to face, but I think she believes in her recovery. Finally, it was time to swap the iron lung for a shell respirator, a metal dome that fits over the chest and abdomen. The next step was moving Nell to a wheelchair with a positive pressure respirator, often used in firefighting, supplying a flow of oxygen. "As soon as she got all those muscles back, we got her transferred into a regular hospital unit," Dillis said. "She was bright and funny and could put up with all sorts of things." But one thing made Nell furious. Despite her progress, she was told that she would never paint again. That prognosis was simply unacceptable. Painting was her life. "Look," she said, "if I can move my hand, I can paint." Seeing long faces around her, she insisted, "If I can't paint, I will write." Enraged, she dismissed a social worker who suggested that she learn basket weaving. Weeks after she entered the hospital, Nell used her left hand, which shook violently, to try to draw with a magic marker. Her right hand was useless, leading her to yell and curse with frustration. With Dillis's urging, Dr. Sweet talked her into undergoing an operation that would transplant muscles from another finger to her right thumb. This allowed her to hold a pen and a pencil. Then, as she said later, the doctors on the ward realized I needed privacy and rigged me up a private studio with curtains. After a late November visit, Levertov reported that Nell had been drawing with her left hand and was just able to hold a pencil with her right hand. A drawing of flowers in a vase was her first post-polio work. Clotted webs of lines scribbled with a marker captured more than a hint of Nell's rhythmic facility. With a ballpoint pen in shaky script, she wrote, "For Dillis N. Blaine." I don't know if you can see it, but Dillis sent me the actual drawing. Because of the atrophied muscles in her right arm, Nell would have to train herself to produce oil paintings using her left hand. She was still unable to write with it, but she could scribble, which gave her the hope that she could eventually paint with this hand. "It took another year to begin to be a little adept at that," Dillis said. "Another year of daily punishing work. It took 2 years before Nell was satisfied with her left-handed paintings. Meanwhile, she kept up a brave front, assuring an interviewer that she would become ambidextrous in time and will invent gadgets to help me. If I'm not able to do large paintings, why then, I'll do small ones. In December, her friends rallied again, donating their work to a benefit exhibition at the Poindexter Gallery, organized by Hess, Eleanor Poindexter, and Leslie Katz, publisher of Arts Magazine. Pieces were contributed by 79 artists, including Willem and Elaine de Kooning, Larry Rivers, Helen Frankenthaler, Hans Hoffmann, Jane Wilson, Hyde Solomon, Robert Motherwell, Saul Steinberg, Robert Rauschenberg. His piece was titled "Well, Nell." Lawrence Campbell, former Jane Streeter Frances Eckstein. The Jane Street Gallery was a strictly abstract gallery that she led in an earlier period of her life. Sculptors Ibram Lassaw and Richard Stankiewicz, and Nell's close friends Jane Freilacher, Robert De Niro, that's the father of the actor, Louisa Matthias' daughter, Leland Bell, and Al Kresh. Priced at $50 to $600 a piece, the work sold briskly, raising enough money to support Nell for the next 2 years. In Art News, Hess wrote that her freshness of touch and insight has brought a sense of youth, gaiety, and summer to the often lugubrious New York school. It was customary to send recovering polio patients to Goldwater Hospital on Roosevelt Island. This institution was advanced for its time with a caring staff, windowed wards, solariums, and a terrace that allowed patients to get fresh air. Desperate to live on her own, Nell refused to go there, unwilling to be shunted away from the life she knew. But crucial aspects of that life had changed forever. She would now require the constant assistance of helpers to enable her to get out of bed, use the toilet, wash, dress, and move around in the world. Chuck Close, a painter best known for his large-scale portraits, had to make similar huge adjustments when he was suddenly incapacitated by a spinal stroke in 1988 at the peak of his career. His work was already selling at high prices in a hot art market, enabling him to afford a specially equipped van, expensive alterations to his studio, and the salaries of helpers. Neil's painting sold at modest prices. Making enough money to live on and support her own helpers would be a never-ending struggle. Bob Bass, her former husband, kindly offered to marry her again, look after her, but she knew that was not the solution. Girded by her childhood experience in overcoming disability, she would summon the courage and natural optimism that somehow horrible things will turn out all right to retrain herself to paint at the highest possible level. Thank you. So, I forgot to say that she was 37 years old. I'm sorry, I meant to say that to begin with. So imagine. And she was so active, she would run up to the canvas. I mean, she was almost exaggeratedly an active painter, not, you know, so, anyway.
Sounds like an unbelievable optimist. I mean, the way she just...
She was just so willful. Well, we have someone here who knew her very, very well, yes. Carolyn Harris.
So how many years was she in the iron lung and recovering?
Well, I mean, months here and months, you know, 8 months in New York and under a year.
Oh, under a year. Oh.
You know, it was months.
It sounded like
but,
forever.
Well, to her, it must have been so, you know. Well,
oh, yeah.
Because you just don't know where the end is going to be, or if there is one. I mean, you know, I do, part of, a little small part of the research was reading books by people who, you know, had lived in an iron lung for periods of time. There's a surprising number of these books, you know, people, I read as many books about people, adults, I mean, that's what I was, you know, concerned with, adults who had polio and how they coped, and that was helpful, of course.
I remember getting the polio shots in the 50s, standing in line in high school to get a polio shot.
There's a film about Tanaquille Leclerc. I mean, really one of the great ballerinas of her day. I know that's not what this book is about, but I did mention her. And there's a film in which they showed the New York City Ballet dancers lining up, and she's just poof, you know, she just didn't feel like getting her shot. You know, didn't realize what happened. So
it's ironic given what's happening today with the anti-vax. I've had to get boosters for polio because I spend a lot of time in and out of Africa. In Ethiopia and Sudan.
Thanks.
So I'm wondering if anybody has a question about writing biographies, or I don't know, how you do something or other. You know, it's hard for me to know what.
Yeah. Sounds like a lot of research.
I'm sorry?
Sounds like you have to do a lot of research.
Well, yes. I mean, yes, of course. Yes.
I mean, I don't know much about polio, like how it starts and all, but does everybody who has polio or had polio need to be in an iron lung? Or is it just certain people?
Well, I'm hardly an expert, and I think most of them do start out that way, and you know, and some people just wound up with a little limp or almost nothing, just as somebody mentioned, and others are not nearly so lucky. And then, well, Nell had post-polio syndrome toward the end of her life, among other things, and you know, it sort of lingers in your body and kind of, I mean, if people have more questions about polio, but I'm not a doctor. Were you going to ask?
Just an observation that your writing style has a verb that matches very nicely the person that you're exalting there. So it's
thank you.
Beautifully done.
I guess I'd like to know, as somebody who's always starting projects, how do you pick who you're going to write about? Like, what?
Well, you know, weirdly, somebody just asked me before this started how I chose Nell, and I mean, I had the monograph, and I enjoyed looking at the paintings. I honestly can't remember exactly how, but it's, I mean, I have to really like their work, and they have to have a really tumultuous, or at least very eventful life, and, I mean, I have to get a contract. I don't self-publish, it's just not my thing, so I have to get a contract. You also have to persuade, well, first my agent, and then, you know, an editor that the information is gettable, is out there, and that the heirs or whoever's in charge of the archive or whatever it is. I mean, her Nell's papers are at the Houghton Library at Harvard, and anybody can look at them. So that in itself wasn't a problem. But once, I mean, I've just had to turn down, you know, walk away from many, many ideas that I've had for biographies. One of them was going to be about an artist, a California artist who died tragically in her, I think, late 40s, early 50s in India when a building fell on her. I mean, it was
oh,
a, you know. So all her possessions were just dumped in boxes and shipped to the States, and her son lives in Chicago. I live in Los Angeles. Her son has decided to put the boxes in storage near San Francisco Airport for some reason. And he told me that, first of all, he would have to accompany me to the storage facility, and all it is just a bunch of stuff. I mean, just her thing. Now, there were biographers who would just love to do that, but I'm not one of them. I like to go. I like to go to, you know, archives, libraries, you know, for that part of it. I like things all sorted out. You know, archival work is interesting. I mean, the rules and regulations, and well, I could say a lot about it. But you know, if nobody's interested in archival work, I won't go on and on. But and then of course there's also interviewing the people who you know knew her, and you know, and Carolyn was just terrific. And so the two women in her life, Nell's life, were really very Dillis and Carolyn were very, very generous with her time. And that was invaluable. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that really, really made it for me, though, is that the archive at the Houghton Library contains Nell's diaries. She poured out her heart in these diaries. It would have been a really different book. I think it would have been a pamphlet or something practically, but the diaries for me were so rich, so intense. I had journals from Grace Hartigan, and Elaine de Kooning kept journals, and nobody knows where they are. And people said to me, "You can't write the biography, you don't have the journals," but her life was interesting enough, and it had enough to do with a lot of other interesting people that, yeah.
Well, you just said it was so rich, and she had all these diaries and all that, and I'm looking at, I haven't seen your book yet, but except that I'm seeing it in your hands, and it looks fairly
thin,
modest, yeah. Right? Like, how did you
But I don't like those big, thick biographies. I mean, it's one thing writing about Lincoln or something, but I mean, I think, well, I'm very opinionated on this subject, I'm afraid, but, you know, who cares what they ate for breakfast? I mean, you have to just, biography is narrative. You're telling a story. You have to have a through line. You have to keep moving. You just don't want to be wandering off in, you know, nooks and byways and crannies and whatnot. I mean, I have a lot of endnotes, and in my endnotes I put sort of interesting information that didn't fit into the story. And then there's other information that just never made it into the book. And no, people always ask, so what was that? And I can't remember. I mean, it wasn't important enough to me.
It didn't,
you know. But, yeah, I don't think most of us want to really read one of those big, thick, you know, biographies that go into the great-great-grandmother. Oh, I just find that so boring. I hate genealogy.
So
I'm sorry.
What was your through line?
Well, that she was an extraordinarily determined person all her life and overcame, you know, numerous obstacles and was incredibly, and in order to do that, was often a very difficult person to live with, to be with, to be the dealer of, the art dealer of, but she persevered, she came through, and now I know there's not everyone agrees with this, but I feel that the work that she did after polio is far superior to the work she did. She used different styles previously, but I think the post-polio work is the great work, and I think it's the post-polio work that makes her one of America's great watercolorists in particular.
Well, she's kind of like Django Reinhardt, who had like this, was in a fire and his fingers were fused together, and he had to continue to play because that was his life.
Right.
So,
and
that imposition created whole new horizons.
So it seems like you're interested in women artists.
Those three, and now the next one is about a writer who is a woman. I think I should write about men. I really do. I mean, it's not. It just kind of turned out that way.
Maybe.
I like to write the first one, though. That's the exciting part, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there aren't, you know, everybody has turned over every stone, it seems. It's hard to find, you know, people of real interest who've done important things in their life and who've had a vibrant and exciting life of one sort or another who have not been written about, you know.
I've got a small, detailed question. The guy that lived in this house, did he ever frame any of Nell Blaine's, Vincent Farini, did he have a relationship with Nell in terms of a framer? Did you ever come across that? I don't happen to know that.
No, I mean, by then, she was really, a lesbian at that point. So.
No, I mean...
not that kind of...
No, he actually was a framer.
I don't know anything about... uncovered anything about Farini, no. I'm sorry.
It may still be out there.
Well, there isn't such thing as a definitive biography. You know, there just isn't, because there's always some new, you know, I mean, every time I write something, there are people who say, well, I have letters in the attic. And I say, oh, great. And they say, I'll try to get to them. And they never do. You know, you can't, unless I were to, you know, go over there and stand over there, you know, stand over them. So who knows, there'd be all kinds of news and revelation and or contradiction or whatever, you know, but you just have to work with what you got, you know.
So how long did she live here and how old was she when she died?
She was, seven, how old was she when she died?
She was twice 37.
Okay.
37 years she was.
That's right, yeah.
So 74.
74. He's dead, very young.
And she bought the house in the mid-70s.
She bought it in 70, bought it in 74.
Four, yeah.
And we came up in 75, and Jeffrey Vachon, and I believe Lovell Parsons helped to raise the roof. It was already a two-story house, and it needed to be raised some more because it was too shallow up in the second floor. Anyway, so she died in 1996.
And where was the house?
Where was the house?
Yeah.
Three Ledge Road.
Oh no!
Oh, okay.
Right on the
The first house on the right as you start up the hill.
And
it had
a
tremendous
beautiful
view, wonderful view.
Yeah, that great view.
And Martin,
when did you start working with Nell?
Like Carolyn.
Oh, I would say.
Oh,
right,
boy.
Well, within 2 years.
There's a lot in the book about the garden and all,
right.
You know.
Probably,
yeah.
I don't remember the early names, and then you came along.
Right.
And so I would put it
late 70s.
About 78 maybe. Mm-hmm. 77, 78.
That's almost the year I started, so it had to be a couple of years after that.
I have two questions. Can you talk about how it came that you decided you were going to be a writer and specifically a biographer is the first question. And then do you prefer to write about people for whom there are living people you can interview and find out more about them? Or?
Oh, interesting question. Okay. Well, number one is I've been a writer much of my life. I used to be on staff at the LA Times, and I was a freelance writer before. I wrote art reviews going back to the mid-70s. So I've been writing, but I had to teach myself how to write a book. Totally different thing.
Writing biography.
I always wanted, I mean, not always, but for several decades wanted to write somebody's biography. And it's the darndest thing because I have a background in art history, but it never occurred to me to write about an artist. So I don't know why, but so there was somebody, I can't remember her name, but she had written a memoir about collecting herbs in South America for medicinal purposes. And it's a subject that did not interest me today at all. I don't know why I got so fixated on it. And then I realized that I would have to myself go down the Amazon, retrace her steps. I hate adventure travel, no thank you. So, and I just kept reaching, going to all these dead ends. I don't know, I can't explain it, but then in the year 2010, I went to New York, and the show Abstract Expressionist New York was at MoMA, and there was this really gorgeous, very large painting. I couldn't quite think who it was, you know, all the big names were there. And I looked at the label, Grace Hartigan, and it just kind of, as I, you know, flew home and thought about it, I had interviewed Hartigan when she came out to California years earlier. She was by then dead. So I called the chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. I said, what do you think? And he said, do it. And the other thing he said, and since we're all adults here, I can say, he said, you gotta mention how she fucked all those guys. So, and I did, but you know, she did have a colorful romantic life. So that kind of did get me going, and I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know how to write a proposal. I didn't have an agent. I just, where there's
just
a will.
Yeah.
Was there another question?
And writing about people who.
Oh,
whom you can talk to.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's been a lovely experience with Nell, but with Elizabeth, it's my first time, I'll be candid, writing about a literary figure, and they circle the wagons. I'm not getting very far. Mm-hmm. However, I've written most of the book anyway. There's plenty out there. I mean, there's her life, you know, with Lowell, and her life in, I was just in Kentucky, retracing her steps, looking at, hoping to look at her house where she grew up, but it's just a piece of land. It's gone. But so there's so much. But somebody reviewing it is going to say, so why didn't I just wrote a letter to Susan Minot, who was one of her students. She Elizabeth taught at Barnard for about 19 years, 60s to the mid 80s. So I wrote Susan Minot a letter. I'll probably never hear from her. I mean, I don't know her. I don't know anyone who knows her. And, you know, I did hear from Ann Beattie, who turns out wasn't a student, but she was very nice about it. But yeah, it's difficult to penetrate these very tight groups. So part of me would, I used to say, my next book's going to be about Nefertiti. You know?
It's not so there's no.
Nobody. Yeah. Martin.
Do you find that you are creating a person when you make a biography? I mean that in the nicest way, but that you necessarily have to do that?
Well, I think, I mean, when you do all the reading, I mean, I have to pull it together and I have to have an opinion, but no, I mean, I feel like I'm just, you know, telling it like it was. I mean, you know, I mean, could you ask the question in a different way?
For a couple of reasons. First of all, the information you're getting disparate information from various sources, right? And you have to choose a theme, a through line, or something that you're presenting to make it to make a strong character portrait, I would think. And then the third thing is that there must be so many things you don't know. So you track along to such a point, and then you might need to color it or fill something in or put words in her mouth or something.
No, never, no, never. Yeah, that's like biographer's hell. Mm-hmm. No, never make, mm-hmm. never do that. But what you just saw with those two versions of how she got to Athens.
Right.
You know, right. I mean, I spoke to, there were just these two versions, and I had to give them both. I felt that the notion that there was no civil aeronautics, in Greece at the time, so it was highly unlikely that you could call up and get helicopter.
Right.
But, that part isn't even important. The important part, I think, is, the urgency and the fact that, how everybody pitched in to make it happen. And never do I or should any reputable biographer ever make up words.
You don't make it up, but you have a point of view.
A point of view, yeah, but I mean, I don't...
Which...
Any words that I'm quoting are from Nell wrote or said.
Or said.
Or, somebody remembered that she... Of course, memories are fallible, I mean, but that we all have to work with, she said, as I recall, she said X, mm-hmm. But I had so many letters. I had, the diary, the journals, and I had letters from people.
Fascinating. Had you ever been to Gloucester before?
No.
No, so mm-hmm. You just came because of...
Yeah, well, the travel, I must say, the travel is really... difficult for me. I don't. I know lots of biographers, and some of them are very well to do, or they're supported by a spouse, and that doesn't. I don't have that. So, I mean, when I go to an archive or a place, I just frantically. I have like 3 days, and I have to just use every single minute. Interviews back to back, or if I'm in an archive, I come when it opens. I don't take lunch. I sit there all day. Cell photos, 200, 300 photos a day, and you reel out of there, and then you come in the next day, and I have, these friends who just, they take several weeks and they visit their friends, and that must be nice.
How long did it take you from start to finish to complete your project there on now?
Lately they've been 2 years, I've published 2015, 2017, 2019. So there've been 2 year projects, but part of that time is actually just, you turn it into your publisher and then they
send it.
Actually, no, but I mean, they just, Oxford, these three books have been published by Oxford University Press, and I have a lovely, lovely editor there. He is the nicest person, but he doesn't edit. University presses rely on, peer reviewers. So they send out your proposal mm-hmm. first to three academics who often drive me crazy because the book that they would write is never the book that I'm writing. Mm-hmm. With Grace, the chapter that I sent out was my favorite. You try to write the liveliest chapter, right? Mm-hmm. And it was Grace at... at the this famous bar in New York, and there she is, and you never learn who writes the reviews, but this clearly an academic. It was like, I don't know what she's trying to do here, but it was just like, it's not the book she would have written, but anyway, then the book itself gets the once over by by the peer people. Before you get your money, your signing, and then there's a copy editor, and that you have to fight with.
Right.
So of course these people are really useful. I mean, they've saved me from all kinds of horrible mistakes, naturally. But they also there's also always something that they don't get or they, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a role in the marketing part of it?
That's the part I like the least. I don't know. I just want to write the next book. But for Oxford, you write a blog entry. Anything to do with writing, sure, I'll write something. That's fine.
Right.
But I enjoyed talking, and I've actually never done a reading before. It's always been a talk, but I'm not on social media. I'm just not interested. It's not my thing. I'm on LinkedIn, yeah, but that's it. So
did your publisher send you to do talks?
Oh no, they don't have any money for that.
No.
I'm hoping Elizabeth will be published by W.W. Norton, so it's a trade publisher. Maybe they'll send me somewhere to Boston or something.
Did your agent place it there for you?
Oh yeah, yeah. The agent does the work.
It's a lot of people to manage. I mean, your editor, your copywriter, your agent.
Well, it's sequential.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, the agent has to believe in it, mm-hmm. and that's tricky in itself because sometimes you think, well, with Elizabeth, there is, I'm not going to say who she is, but there is a person who is well-placed in the literary world of New York who has a contract. She got it 9 years ago to write a biography called, I've heard it two different ways, the Two Mrs. Lowells. And so my agent said, well, you can't write, I wasn't going to write about the other ones, I'm just going to write about Elizabeth. But she said, well, anyway, you can't, there's just no room for another book. But fortunately, I know, see, this is, you just, it's all about knowing people. It's just so annoying in that way. But I know someone who knows this person who got the contract, and it turns out that she hasn't really been working on it. That just kills me. You know, these people get these important contracts. That this writer has a very famous agent, and she has a very famous editor at a very famous publishing house, and then she's decided she's actually, for one reason or another, going to do something else, you know. But they don't raise a little flag and say, okay, now you can do it, you know. So
knowing that,
just do it.
But no, I can't, but I had to convince my agent, though.
Yeah.
And she said, okay. And it was only then that I sent her my proposal, and we simply didn't mention this other book, which, I mean, this woman is several years older than I am and not well now. I mean, I wish her, it's not her, I have a problem with her. It's just, the problem is simply that mm-hmm. with the whole notion of people who get a fancy contract, you know, and but she also is a very slow writer, because this friend of hers says, well, I mean, she took 10 years to write her last book, but I'm fast, so... You know, I figure, well, you know, I'll do my book, and then she can do her book. And but it publishing is just so difficult nowadays. It's really, really hard. So I've run so many ideas by my agent, and she says, you know. Did someone have a question?
What is your writing process? Do you have a?
I write every single day. I'm just totally driven. It's my entire life. I'm really boring, you know. if I don't write, I don't feel quite, you know, like I wander around my house, and I just, it's just something, you know, that must get done.
But do you have a routine, or are you just...
Well, you know. I try to get to it early. I wake up early. And you know that phrase, being in the flow, I'm really believe, you know, because hours go by and then you look up like, oh, you know, when you're in it. I mean, it's not every day, of course, but and just a great deal of rewriting. But I don't have separate drafts. I just figure it's just keeps getting better. And I have something called cutting room, where if I fall in love with a sentence that it doesn't seem to fit, I put it in cutting room, never use it. You know, there's that phrase, kill your darlings,
yeah,
in writing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, but it makes you feel good. Oh, I'm putting it in cutting room, okay, you know. But
I have to get rid of it.
Yeah, I'm not really getting rid of it, but I never use that stuff. I never even look at it again. So, you know, and I just keep going over and over and over the, you know, and of course you're flowing in, you know, I do this sort of a skeleton. Well, first I do the sample chapter so I can get, you know, for the proposal. That is the most important part of a nonfiction, literary nonfiction proposal. I mean, not if it's 100 ways to lose weight or something, but, you know. that, so, you know, you really, really polish that chapter. And I always pick, of course, the chapter for which I have the most information at that moment, you know. So this, in fact, this chapter, I only read a part of it, was my sample chapter for the proposal. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then I sort of ran, I don't really write the chapters in order necessarily, but I know what they'll cover. And then when I learn new information, I'd start writing really early. And then when I get new information, I just feed it in, which often means adjusting. No, you can't just plop in. You have to figure out how to finesse it. I mean, I've read, there's a very good book about, you know, literary nonfiction called How to Write Like Your Editor, I think it is. And I like this woman's advice, except for the part where she says, don't start writing too early. I'm thinking, why?
In the morning?
No, in the process.
Oh.
You know, collect all your information. But I have these biographer friends, they've been collecting for years. I mean, it's like, so write, start, do it. You know?
How do you know what information you don't have, please start.
Exactly.
Find out your story.
That's exactly. Yes, that's the whole thing. I mean,
so did you do this with your first book too? I mean, if having never written a book before, you knew to somehow make that sample chapter?
Well, I mean, it's, there's just advice all over the internet on how to, you have to have, you know, a proposal has these things in it, and it has to have a sample chapter in nonfiction.
But you didn't just write the book and then worry about that.
Oh no, I mean, that's really amateurish, if you forgive me, but I mean, okay. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but I mean,
because
there's so many books out on how to write, but you know, it's interesting because I'm a mentor in this biographers group, and people are always asking, how do you do it? And I just, the information is all over the place, but you know, you have to have the summary and the this and the that, and you know, it's just a laundry list of stuff. But the sample chapter, because that's how you, the sample chapter tells
what it is,
the editor, how you write. I mean, I'm going to write about Lincoln, and I have brand new material. I found, you know, a dozen diaries that nobody has. Okay, but how do you write? You know, I'm sorry, that was really rude of me.
No, don't worry about it. I've been worse than. Don't even think about it.
Did you have one final question, and then we'll?
Yeah, I was wondering if you included Nell's artwork in the book.
Oh yes, I did. There's an insert. Oh well, that's just a bit of a story in itself. There is an insert, I'm just opening at random, of colored plates. I write the book first and then I collect the artwork as best I can. And it's a problem with Nell because much of her work is in private collections. So the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts has comparatively a lot of work. And of course the Cape Ann Museum has two pieces. I just reproduced one. A lot of it comes from Tibor Dinaj Gallery because they let me have them for free. I mean, it is, you know, you spend all the money on traveling and everything, and then you have to purchase the rights, the rights. So hundreds of dollars.
What happened to Arthur Cohen's collection of her work?
Do you know? I mean, he gave it to some museums. It's not really clear, though.
No.
Didn't he? No, I don't.
He gave it to someone, and I'm afraid I can't tell you who it is.
Oh, interesting.
But that was large.
It was very large, yes.
He owned at least 150 works.
Wow.
I should have asked you, because I kept looking to see somewhere where it would say donated by, and
oh,
I couldn't.
Oh, I know. He gave it to his boyfriend. Nahum Niv, who is Israeli. So there's no telling.
See, there's always things that the writer either stupidly never thought to ask, like in this case, or, you know, doesn't know. So
it sounds as if she was quite a prolific artist.
Oh, she was.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when she started, there were all the years when she was painting abstractly and in a very severe fashion. She became a sort of acolyte of Mondrian, and they're interesting paintings, but I don't think she would have been famous for them or anything, you know.
That turned out well in that many of the works were she was able to retrieve several, which was important, and I could have conservation done on them. You know, they were often in bad condition. There was one at UC Berkeley that we recalled.
Oh, really? I used to work there.
Just sent it back to them and told them it needed conservation.
Now, the Met has Lester Leaps.
That required conservation, too.
Lester Young is the Lester. She was a great, I mean, I only read this little bit, but she was a jazz fanatic, played the drums. And of course, I had to get... Sorry?
I haven't come across that one. I'm doing a film on Lester Young.
Oh, well, it's in the book in black and white, and the reason for that is that the Met only has a black and white photo of it, and so I don't know if they can. It's got red in it too, so I don't know why that was, and I had to keep moving at that point, and I didn't. I'm afraid I didn't find out.
Can I see the photo?
Yeah.
Some news to me.
Jeez, Henry.
Yeah, jeez, right here in Gloucester. You think Peter would tell me that, or somebody? Jeez. Lester Leaps In. That was like his signature.
Yeah,
joke.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let's see here.
Do you talk about Lester in there?
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
There you go.
Yeah,
you're going to have to read it. Buy the book.
Here it is. Lester Leaps. Oh, it's fortuitous.
I can see Joe Jones in there. Willie, do you see
President there?
On the right?
Which one? On the right?
Yeah. That's like sort of
no.
Lester Seeps In there almost.
Seeps In, really.
Yeah.
No, I can't find his hat, so I'm lost.
Yeah.
Well, do you see? I see a hand holding a baton.
Well,
a drumstick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His first instrument.
Oh, okay. Because
right.
I thought, why it doesn't.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
He held it in a very peculiar way.
And Nell held her brush much as she held her own drumstick.
Huh.
I
hear.
Very interesting.
Wow.
Really.
Thank you so much for coming. I think we'll now
thank you.